Hi, guys. Here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil. Next, I take an ice bath. Ooh, feeling super healthy.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Hey, all, I'm John Avalon, and welcome to How to Fix It. As you know, the purpose of this podcast is to focus on finding solutions to the problems we face, not simply endlessly fixating on the problems themselves. But right now, solutions seem like a distant land. I'm speaking to you on the afternoon of September 11th, Thursday. Charlie Kirk, the MAGA influencer, was assassinated at a college campus yesterday. And it brings to mind how much we all need to lower the decibels right now, how we need to remember, as hard as it may seem, that what unites us as Americans is greater than what divides us. And we can and should have great debates, but we cannot allow them to escalate into violence. Joining me this week is Nick Gillespie, the legendary libertarian editor of Reason. Someone I have sought to find common cause with at different times over the years. And Nick, I just want to begin with your thoughts on not just the assassination of Charlie Kirk, but the repercussions across our political culture.
You know, it, first off, the, you know, the act of the assassination, you know, a single shot from a distance at a college campus where, you know, Kirk is actively engaging in debate, you know, in the kind of good debate that we should be modeling and having more of. It's absolutely terrifying. And we're clearly in a spasm of political violence, you know, and it is stochastic. It is difficult to predict, but it's never quite surprising when it happens. You know, a month ago, there was the guy who shot up the CDC. Yep. You know, and then I guess killed himself earlier this year, the murder of a Minnesota legislator and her husband, and the shooting of two others, a legislator and his wife. You know, we're in weird times. The celebration of Luigi Mangione for killing a healthcare executive. I don't know that we are, you know, we're back to the early 70s when political violence globally was just taken for granted. And it was kind of almost an everyday experience. I hope not. And the big question is, like, how do we shift out of this mode into something that is less destructive and horrific? Donald Trump gave a speech, you know, last night about Kirk. And part of it was good and part of it was bad, because, you know, this is the problem with our political culture right now, is that everybody is fixated on getting, you know, getting the last shot in, you know, literally and figuratively. Nobody can say, OK, this was bad. What preceded it was bad. And now we're going to do something good. It's just this kind of thesis, antithesis, without getting to a point where we say, OK, we need to start over. We need a reboot. So I'm very disturbed by it. And it's, you know, it's just, it's a terrible moment to be living through.
It is. And yet we will get through it. I think you're right to mention the political violence of the early 70s, late 1960s. It provides a reality check, just that we have been through worse. But that, of course, there is the danger of escalation. And one thing I was struck by is, and you're right to put it in the larger context of the escalation of political violence recently, but every leading Democrat immediately came out to condemn the violence and to offer love and support for Charlie Kirk's family.
I think that's the start. Yeah,
that's the start. But I was really troubled by things like Elon Musk saying that the left is the party of murder.
Yeah. It is a mentally retarded statement on a million different levels. Just, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You know, the left is not a political party. You know, to, you know, this encapsulates the problem. And, you know, I think I am a big believer in social media and all forms of media that allow more people to express themselves more fully and to reveal themselves. But, you know, Musk is part of the problem, you know, when he talks like this, because it's a meaningless statement that does nothing other than, you know, pour gasoline on a fire that's already raging.
And that, of course, is the great danger. You know, you've been very committed and Reason has been very committed. And I think philosophically consistent, which is really important right now, about the importance of honest, good debate. Right. You know, you can disagree without demonizing somebody. We should be able to debate anything. That's the essence of free speech, which was allegedly what a lot of some of Trump supporters and Charlie Kirk supporters always said they were standing for. You use the phrase stochastic terrorism, yeah. Which is sort of, you know, escalating rhetoric of incitement and threat. And that's where we all need to take a deep breath right now. We need to be make sure we do not add gasoline on this fire, that we don't reduce it to a war between parties. And we don't look for the aggressive defensiveness, which is used to excuse further violence. I want to just ask you from a libertarian perspective. One of the issues is having mentally unstable people having access to lots of firearms. Right. I don't expect this assassination is going to change the terms of the debate. The shooting at the softball game, which Steve Scalise narrowly survived, did not do that. But I wonder just how you take into account America's somewhat uniquely troubled relationship with mass gun violence at a moment like this.
You know, it's a good question. I mean, historically, you know, and this is going back to the colonial period, America not only was a highly armed or, you know, population, but also a violent population. We've, you know, as long as records can be kind of figured out, we've been more violent than most of Europe outside of war and things like that. I became a defender of liberalized gun laws, meaning allowing more people to own guns and carry them in more circumstances, mostly because when this started to happen, the liberalization of gun control laws started in the 90s at the exact moment that criminologists across the board, across all ideologies, were predicting the rise of what were then called super predators. And they expected gun violence to continue to increase. It had been increasing for decades and it started falling. And there's no question that guns are what kill people, you know, and a gun, somebody with a gun killed Charlie Kirk, you know, somebody with a gun shot, President Trump. Or, you know, a candidate Trump at that point and Ronald Reagan and, you know, shot at Gerald Ford, et cetera. But the fact is that the increase in the circulation of the number and types of guns and the circumstances under which people are legally allowed to carry them has not led to an increase in gun violence. And so that to me, you know, is, I don't want to say it's comforting because that's the wrong term, but like, I don't know how you go about disarming a population that doesn't, you know, massively, you know, violate people's civil liberties and actually reduces crime. Most of the mass shooters that we've seen have been, you know, they've purchased their guns legally. You know, they've gone through background checks and things like that. So it's tough. I mean, the one thing that I take some solace in is that gun violence in general is down. The place where it is actually up, you know, and this is over the past 25, 30 years, is with suicide. And that presents a harder challenge because most libertarians and certainly most Second Amendment people are against red flag laws, which are often invoked in order to disarm people who seem suicidal. And I do, you know, I'm probably more amenable to the idea of them than a lot of my colleagues, both at Reason or in the libertarian movement. But I think that represents something, you know, something of a challenge that we need to think about. How do you make sure, you know, that it's, you know, 30,000 plus people commit suicide with a gun every year. I mean, there are more gun suicides than there are gun homicides. And suicide seems to be something that is an impulsive action. And like, you know, there are people who could be saved from killing themselves, you know, through a timely intervention. And the question then is, how do you do that in a way that doesn't turn us, you know, into a society that becomes markedly less free?
That's a good place to start a conversation. I think very often we escalate to sort of catastrophic lines of debate. And I think nobody who supports reasonable gun reforms is talking about forcibly disarming anybody, law-abiding legal gun owners. But that is that's a place where you can start to find common ground. You know, it does remind me that you have been, and Reason has been, admirably consistent with regard to Donald Trump for a long time. Folks on the right, and there are different competing tribes, sort of made the argument that that they were, you know, free people, free markets was one mantra, you know, that was a bridging mantra between different wings. The libertarians were certainly not in the driver's seat during the Bush years, but there seemed to be a boomlet around Ron Paul, then Rand Paul. And what has been stunning to me in the Trump years, especially surrounding this Trump presidency, is to see the 180 on the part of many different facets of the conservative movement, whether it's about the importance of, you know, restraining spending, civil liberties, distrust of an imperial executive. You know, I could go on and we will break this down, but just abandoning all that. Milton Friedman, who he?
It's shameful. It's shameful. Yeah.
Well, how do you account? Because you guys have been consistent. And again, I want to a civil, consistent, principled debate. My idea is always principle above partisanship. We've seen the exact opposite. And I wonder how you see so many of your former fellow travelers in the broadest sense. Discarding all the things that had been used as conservative catechism for so long, basically on a dime. How do you understand that?
I assume it's proximity to power, to imagined proximity to power or something like that. But and I also think there are a lot of people in the broad conservative movement, I would say, because, you know, that's who's pushing Trump, or the populist right. As a libertarian, I never felt like I was part of the right, because I was always as interested in things like, you know, drug legalization and equality under the law for gays and other, you know, sexual as well as racial and ethnic minorities, you know, causes that were either actively degraded by conservatives or just ignored. And I believe in, you know, truly free markets, in a way that most conservatives don't. And I think, you know, what the second Trump term definitely has done, it's unmasked that, like, there is a group of conservative right wingers in America who do not believe, you know, they are effectively post-liberal. They don't believe in a limited government. They believe in a government that can tell people to live the way that they want to. And that comes down to, you know, it comes down to trade, where, you know, Donald Trump has invoked a bunch of fake emergencies in order to pass universal tariffs that are going to be challenged in court. And I think they will be overturned, where he has, you know, talked about we have an invasion underway so that the, you know, ICE agents can just kind of randomly pick up people because they look Mexican or something. I mean, this is outrageous and disgusting. The right, when it's out of power, it usually is very big on, civil liberties, because they feel like they're a marginalized minority that's going to be, you know, hauled off to FEMA concentration camps or something, you know, ludicrous like that. But then when you're faced with agents of the government who are masked, who don't identify themselves and are picking people up, you know, they're kind of like, oh, well, we have to do that because of illegal immigration, or fake stories about, you know, legal Haitian refugees and asylees cooking dogs and cats in Springfield, Ohio, or something like that. So it's disgusting. And I think it's, you know, there are less people than you assume who believe that America is a place where you can live the way you want. Other people got to live the way they want. We have to agree on certain things that everybody abides by. But, you know, the whole point is that we are a pluralistic country where lots of different people are doing lots of different things. That's what makes us stronger. That's what makes us rich. That's what makes us interesting. That's what makes us the envy of the world. You know, the Republicans used to talk like that a lot, and they don't mean it. And the minute that they've seized the controls, you know, they're willing to kind of go along with somebody like Trump. you know, and I think it's worse in the second term than it was in the first term. In his first term, he was a loudmouth, but he, you know, he kind of governed as more or less a centrist Republican. You know, this time around, he, I think he realizes, you know, there is no third term, and like he's going to do what he's going to do.
Well, I would take I disagree intensely that he behaved more or less like a centrist Republican.
I don't mean that, by the way. That is a term of derision for me. I mean, it meant that, you know, he increased the debt. God, what was it, by like $8 trillion, $7.8 trillion, the majority of which came before COVID.
That's correct.
You know, so it's like the whole idea of, you know, and it almost seems like, I guess I want to insist on it. You know, I was going to say, like, the whole idea of like, oh, you know, what would be nice, a government that actually, you know, spent as much as it brought in taxes rather than, you know, putting 30 cents of every dollar on the credit card or something like that. That seems quaint to care about budget issues, but like, that is a huge thing. And the Republican Party, longer than the Democratic Party, was at least rhetorically committed to, you know, balancing the budget. They would never cut spending. You know, they would cut taxes, but not cut spending. But now that's totally, you know, off the, you know, it's not even being discussed anymore anywhere in the Republican Party, except for Rand Paul and a couple of people in Congress who are being primaried by Trump. You know, it's really deeply disturbing.
It's crazy because, you know, as a centrist who doesn't see it as a point of derision, and I've always believed that the center left and libertarians of the non-privatizing lighthouse variety can find a lot of common ground.
Oh, totally. Totally.
But you know, it became very clear a long time ago that Republicans only gave a damn about the deficit and the debt when a Democrat was president.
That's right.
It's just how many times are we can get Lucy in the football. But of course, it's more sinister than this now. You use the phrase post-liberal. First of all, I think we should establish that, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, you see a lot of overlap between liberalism and libertarianism, presumably.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, liberalism, 19th century liberalism or classical liberalism is essentially what libertarianism is. And it's, you know, the idea of a limited government, generally free markets, and a great deal of autonomy for individuals to choose, you know, how to live. I think what happened, you know, over the course of the 20th century, liberalism became more identified with, you know, first progressives and a lot of economic regulation and also lifestyle control. And then, you know, under people like FDR and LBJ and whatnot, it really became synonymous with a large government that was, you know, really taking more and more decisions out of people's hands. And, you know, libertarianism is more a term that really came into being after World War II. But I agree with you. You know, there's, you know, there's fewer than there should be, but there are free market Democrats who, you know, they tend to be good on civil liberties and on like lifestyle issues, things like the, you know, abortion rights, you know, the drug legalization, things like that. And then, you know, also who believe that businesses should have a pretty broad hand in, you know, running their businesses the way they want to. That's the center of the country. There used to be more Republicans there. They seem to have vanished. And, you know, so it's, you know, it's kind of lonely in the center, but, you know, it's a good place to be.
Welcome. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I agree with you. And I also think that, you know, we may not care about fiscal responsibility, but fiscal responsibility is going to care about us.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, sooner or later, you know, when you're spending, you know, all your discretionary income off interest on the debt and you don't have the dollars to do anything, that people are going to give a damn. But the problem is then, of course, it's too late. I want to press the point because what is happening is, of course, more troubling. For a long time, you had sort of cognitive dissonance between Republicans and their power talk about the unitary executive and they're out of power and they talk about Western conservatism.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we say post-liberal, to me, the opposite of liberal libertarian is authoritarian. And I don't mean that in terms of, you know, autocratic totalitarian state necessarily. I mean, an authoritarian personality type.
Yeah, I know. I agree. And, you know, troubling to me, somebody like J.D. Vance, because he is younger and he represents the possible or a possible future of the Republican Party after Trump, you know, he recently tweeted after the U.S. bombed a Venezuelan ship that may or may not have been carrying drugs that were going to enslave Americans, et cetera. He said, you know, Donald Trump wants regime change in Venezuela, and Donald Trump as the president gets to do regime change if he wants to. And it's kind of like, holy cow, like, you know, J.D. Vance, the only good thing that you talked about once you emerged into politics was the idea that maybe our foreign policy is kind of screwed up. And now he's claiming, you know, when you talk about the unitary executive or you talk about, you know, due process is for losers. Right. Like it's, you know, we don't need Congress. We don't need to follow the Constitution. We don't need any restraints on the executive branch. And it's like, no, that's actually kind of a big deal. And that's the whole point.
It's kind of a big deal. And Rand Paul and the vice president got in sort of a Twitter spat when, in addition to sort of excusing regime change, Vance was like, I don't give a damn what you call it. Right. And this is basic sort of due process, civil liberty, you know, judge, jury and executioner actions outside of explicit wartime. And first of all, it makes me wonder what the hell's going on at Yale Law School where he graduated from a degree. But what do you see? Because I see a lot of Republicans rationalizing it because that's sort of, you know, the road to hell's paved with rationalizations.
Yeah, yeah, you know, no, and it's Biden did this, Biden did that, and, you know, before him, Obama did, et cetera. And like even, you know, Trump, you know, and this was stunning to me, like he was not only has he signed, you know, like 200 plus executive orders and executive actions since taking power this term. He was bragging about it on Truth Social and on Twitter. And it's like, what is going on? Like, this is a guy who literally, when Obama was president, was constantly critiquing the president and saying, like, that's not how things are done. And then you hear, you know, Republicans or Trump supporters, and it's really a MAGA phenomenon. I don't even know if the Republican Party exists in any kind of meaningful way anymore. But, you know, they're saying, well, you know what, this is how you have to do it because, like, Congress won't do anything. And again, it's kind of like, no, that's the point, right, is that, like, leadership is not scaring people and telling people what to do or just go ahead and doing it. Leadership is actually building a consensus. And like that process is not some kind of quaint, you know, ritual or bit of etiquette. That is a discovery process by which we come to better policy and better standing in the world. And it's like, you know, this is not good stuff. I will say, you know, when you raise the specter of authoritarianism, I think, you know, part of where I, you know, compared to the modal bulwark subscriber, certainly, I don't think Trump is Hitler. I don't think.
Neither do I. I think Hitler's Hitler. Yeah,
that's right. Hitler is Hitler. There were times in his first term, like he definitely likes to push the envelope and like try and go as far as he can. Every time in his first term, when he got slapped back by the courts or by Congress in rare cases, he pulled back and he stopped. And I think what we're seeing now is with the tariff stuff, with some of the National Guard deployments, which are absolutely terrifying to me. The idea that the president is going to figure out when it's time to send troops or, you know, National Guardsmen into L.A. or Chicago or even D.C., where at least he has more of a role to play, or the federal government is more of a role to play. These are being challenged. And if he continues to persist in them after that, we have entered a whole new territory. And like, that is terrifying to me. But this, this is the kind of line that is yet to be crossed. And it's deeply worrying.
And to be clear, I was talking about authoritarian personality types, right?
And
being the opposite of liberal or libertarian.
I agree with that. But I'm just saying, like, kind of in authoritarian policies, because, you know, we've had an imperial presidency, or the presidency is always getting more imperial because for a variety of reasons. And, you know, really, as bad as any given president is, it's also worth, you know, calling out Congress. I mean, they are just feckless. Both parties, like, just refuse to do what they need to be doing in Congress. But to get to this question of the authoritarian personality, there's a book from the early part of this century by Karen Stenner, who was at the time, she's no longer there, was a political scientist at Princeton, and was called either the authoritarian mindset or the authoritarian mentality, something like that. And she talked about two broad groups of people, authoritarians and libertarians, and she didn't mean them in political ways, but authoritarians prized a kind of unified shared set of beliefs of cuisine. They liked uniformity in everything, in like demographics, in religion, in food, in, you know, aesthetics. And then libertarians were people who just liked diversity, you know, like different things. And they were more adventure seeking and kind of, you know, they looked for new experiences. And I think about it in these terms because like it, part of what's going on with MAGA is this insistence that we are not, you know, we're not a melting pot. We're not a glorious mosaic. We're not a lot of different types of people who are living peacefully and kind of interestingly next to one another. We are all one thing. And that terrifies me because that is very antithetical to, I think, the American ideal and also the American reality. And this is what is bothering me. And when, you know, people like Elon Musk, even though he's a newcomer here, he clearly seems to think certain types of people who may have been in America or their families may have been in America longer than his, but they don't really belong here. You know, this type of thing is terrifying to me.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what Elon Musk believes, but I do know that's what Missouri Senator Eric Schmidt believes. And how I know that is because he told us. In a speech this past weekend, he gave a full-throated, written, not an off-the-cuff misstatement endorsement of a blood and soil nationalism being at the heart of the American experiment, that we're not a nation of immigrants, that we're essentially
that we're not a propositional nation, that we're not creedal, that like the true American, and he invoked the term true American in his speech, but you know, is not somebody who comes here and believes in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or somebody who's living in, you know, outer Slobovia and is, you know, can be a true American if they believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. No, no. It's like, yeah, you got to be here and you got to be from Germany or from the, you got to be or of Scots-Irish descent and have come through the Appalachians. I'm sorry to jump the gun on this, but, you know, that speech was titled "What is an American?" which is a callback to Jean Crevecoeur's Letters from an American Farmer, where he has an essay that is called "What is an American?" And Crevecoeur, who was a French descent, he was like a French Huguenot living in upstate New York, talked about, you know, the American is, you know, somebody who, you know, whose parents were one thing, his children are something completely different. And it's, you know, Dutch and French and English and Irish and, you know, whatever. And it's a new race of men, you know, and he's obviously bound by his time, but it is not pure blood at all. It is like, you know, it is a mongrel. It's a hybrid that is going to be constantly changing. It's creative destruction, you know, on the cellular level in America. And that is like for Eric Schmidt to be using the title of that speech to talk about how like the real Americans are my ancestors who kind of came to Missouri in the 1800s. It's mind-boggling. It's deeply disturbing.
Well, and this is a sitting U.S. senator. This is not a dog whistle. It's a bullhorn. This is the when people tell you what they believe, you know, believe them. He is saying that he is MAGA because he believes that essentially we are a white nation. From a series of earlier immigrations, and that's the purpose, rather than being a creed nation, as you say, open to any willing souls wants to work hard, play by the rules, and subscribe to our founding ideals, and that we're constantly in evolution. How, you know, some people hear this conversation, they say, you know what, that's just all talk. To me, it's a lot more sinister because it's being said explicitly out loud in a written speech by a sitting U.S. senator. And yet made barely a ripple.
Yeah. And at a conference, you know, the 5th annual National Conservative Conference, which is full bore behind, Donald Trump and immigration exclusionism. I mean, John, and I suppose your listeners know this about you, but, you know, both of us are passing, right, as true Americans, because like within, you know, relatively recent history, you know, we have people who came from, you know, Southern Europe or the wrong parts of the world, et cetera. And so, like, when I hear this kind of stuff, it makes me think back to, my Italian grandparents on my mother's side who never learned to speak English and were great Americans. The last time I got this exercise about this was when Steve King, the racist Republican from Iowa, went on a big thing about how, he was channeling Geert Wilders of, a nativist in the Netherlands about how you can't save civilization with somebody else's babies, by which he meant like the children of immigrants. And I was like, oh, my God, like it made me, years after they died, it made me realize my parents were other people's babies. And, they were the children. My father was the son of Irish immigrants, my mother of Italian, and they were great Americans. My father fucking fought in World War II and got a Purple Heart. My uncles on my mother's side, fought in World War II in Korea. They paid the price of admission to the U.S. by working hard, but also by offering their bodies. To start talking about blood and soil in a 21st century where we know that, the country needs the best people from all around the world if we want to continue to prosper, if we want to continue to innovate, if we want to continue to increase our standards of living. It's deeply, deeply disturbing, and it's also self-defeating. This is the part of the kind of cultural manifestations of MAGA that worry me the most. That, in the late 90s, and this was after, Bill Clinton had managed to elect a Republican Congress in 1994 by doing everything he wanted in his first 2 years as president. He destroyed the Democratic stranglehold on Congress. But by the end of the 90s, we had learned that the era of big government was over, and there had been a kind of peace sued where people seem to be more comfortable with a kind of individualism that was regnant. And I always think of Tiger Woods in the 90s. He defined himself as a Cabla Nation because he was Caucasian, Black, Indian, Native American, and Indian, Asian, Indian. And he came up with the moniker.
Call that American,
but that was the point, right? Is that like he is something, he is Crevecoeur's American, where it's like almost unimaginable, but it's like beautiful and wonderful. And we had a comfort level, I think, for at least for a few years, finally, with a kind of mongrelized, hybridized, ultra-personalized American identity, realizing that we, all of us, are American as long as we believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that window has been shut closed. It's been painted closed by the MAGA people. And it goes back to this concept that Karen Stenner was talking about authoritarianism, like that is threatening to some people. And I think, they are not just wrong, but fundamentally wrong. And we need to figure out how to talk to people like that so they can understand that an open-ended society and an open-ended America is not the end of America. It's actually the beginning of the next great era of America.
That's exactly right. And here's where we're in radical agreement. That has always been the secret to our success. And yes, do we need to teach civic education to inculcate their values? Absolutely, in my worldview. This speech to have a sitting U.S. senator come out and basically say, this is Christian nationalism was on the fringes when I wrote Wingnuts 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And now it's been elevated. And it does mean that a lot of the folks who've rationalized their own empowerment or advancement of MAGA through their own prism need to recognize that they don't get to do it a la carte. Right. And this is where I want to go in the time we have left. I want to talk about sort of where is the outcry given the principles at stake? And then how do you see us being able to heal this? So let's just talk about this. See, there's been a lot of, the disagreements with Zohran Mamdani on any number of issues. But let's just take, he wants to have a city-owned grocery store in 5 boroughs, which I think is a bad idea on several levels. But the people who were talking about that obsessively seem to be comparatively silent about the president taking a 15% stake in private companies if they want to sell to China, or 10% in Intel, which, in that I could even rationalize it to say that they got a big federal government investment. But I mean, you're talking about...
Yeah, a golden share in U.S. Steel, U.S. Nippon Steel merger.
And more is coming. We're being told that the U.S. government, this is anything beyond Bernie Sanders' biggest fever dreams. I mean, putting aside that we're actually having a protectionist trade policy, which is folks that a lot of your supporters and friends and have been warning about. But they seem comparatively silent.
Yeah.
And this is core fundamental stuff. Where is that degree of philosophical consistency that you've had in the pages of Reason that a lot of your friends, supporters, and donors seem to be dismissing, compartmentalizing, when it couldn't be a more clear and urgent danger against what they allegedly believe in?
I totally agree with you. And, you know, two things. One is that I know, you know, and I live in New York City, and I fear a Mamdani victory, which seems almost to be a fait accompli at this point.
Nothing's a fait accompli.
But yep. because of the, you know, economic restrictions that he, you know, he won't be able to do much of it, I think, but it's not good. And like, you know, I've been, you know, I was born in Brooklyn in the 60s, and I've lived here on and off, you know, for a good chunk of my life. And, you know, I think we may be entering, or we're already partway through, a cycle of New York being governed by really dumb idiot people who really hurt the city. You know, and it started with de Blasio. Eric Adams is no good. I don't think Mamdani is going to be good. And the worst part is the restrictions on, you know, on business. Like, you know, he's the opposite of an abundance agenda guy. Having said any of that, I agree with you completely about, you know, the abdication on the part of conservatives to call out Trump for state capitalism. You know, that he's like he's channeling Xi Jinping as opposed to anything like Ronald Reagan. And I think that part of it is that, you know, conservatives, and this was something when the Cold War ended, you know, conservatives and libertarians had always been in a kind of alliance because there was a belief that, you know, communism was an existential threat to not just free enterprise, but to, you know, freedom of conscience and freedom of speech and everything. And I realized in the 90s that, you know, a lot of conservatives did not actually believe deeply in free enterprise. What they believed, they thought capitalism was good because it would help defeat the Soviet Union, because a planned economy was a less efficient way to run a society. But the minute the Soviet Union was gone, they started becoming very interested in regulating a lot of stuff, or in, you know, they started becoming real critics of capitalism on the grounds that, you know, well, capitalists will sell anything. You know, they'll sell drugs, they'll sell porn. The market is not going to be, you know, morally instructed to do, you know, what, you know, will Bill Kristol or, you know, or Bill Bennett wanted. And I think what we're seeing now is kind of the end game of that, which is that, like, if I'm in power, I get to call the shots. And it's deeply disturbing. And I think the answer is, how do you educate younger people who might be thinking that they're conservative, but they're actually libertarian, where you want to live in a free society, which means first and foremost, freedom of thought, freedom of conscience, freedom of lifestyle, and then also economic freedom. Because you're not going to get that. You're not going to get that in a continuation of MAGA policies.
I couldn't agree more. I'm going to press the point once more, though. You know, a lot of the folks who who are libertarians are often very successful, right? Free markets, free people. And yet they seem comparatively silent about what is clearly not just a threat, but something that if Bernie Sanders did half of, they'd be screaming bloody murder 24/7.
I don't. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, like, the libertarians that I talk to or and argue and kvetch with are, you know, very deeply, deeply disturbed by Trump's, you know, his taking an action. I mean, I talk about him as, you know, he's not Mussolini, but he is Tony Soprano. And it's like, everybody, every CEO in the country has to come around and drop a thick envelope off every once in a while. And you saw this. I mean, it was disturbing as hell at the inauguration when you saw all of the tech CEOs kind of sitting cramped in the, you know, at the inauguration. But then, you know, Tim Cook, who Trump, because he's kind of out of it, calls Tim Apple half the time, you know, dropped off that ugly sculpture that he put on Trump's desk. Like, you know, this is wrong. And it is, you know, weirdly, Trump has formed, you know, the corporatism that he has ushered in is deeply disturbing. But I think he got there because when, you know, if you believe Mark Andreessen, you know, the head of Andreessen Horowitz, you know, when Biden, he became a Trump supporter when Biden told him, like, hey, you know, you're not making AI anymore. Like, you got to come through me. So they rolled with Trump. Silicon Valley gave him a lot of money and they helped him, you know, I think they helped him win. And now they are okay with this stuff because they think they will benefit from it. But it is an absolute betrayal of principle. And it's not going to end well. It's not going to end well for the basic economy. We're already starting to see how, you know, when you zero out immigration and when you rack up, you know, ridiculous tariffs that make no economic sense, it's not good for the economy. And I think these guys are going to realize ultimately it's also going to hurt them.
Well, you know, belatedly, but already, you know, we saw law firms make the Faustian bargain out of the gate.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
we've seen universities being policed to a far greater degree than anything, you know, conceivable in the past in America. I mean, cash payments and struggle sessions and companies frozen for fear that they won't be able to have mergers unless they pay fealty or play a, you know, a vig in one case, quite literally, and threats to media. And sort of what seems to be sort of a media capture strategy of the kind we saw with Orban. That's all a libertarian nightmare. Tell me where I'm wrong.
No, I agree with you. And also, you know, the kind of weaponizing of the FTC as well as the FCC, you know, which are increasingly kind of outdated. And ultimately, I think you can make a strong case that both of them should be abolished. I mean, they are, you know, kind of FDR era regulatory bodies that govern a world that no longer needs them. But the point is that they have a huge amount of political power. And when you see Trump starting to do that, his FCC chair is terrible, you know, and is threatening, you know, because edits to an interview with Kamala Harris, you know, like CBS is ponying up money. This is insane. The question then, I guess, and this is the point, like, if I had the answer, I wouldn't be talking to you, I guess. But like, how do you get the people who are most affected by this to, you know, stand up on their hind legs and actually fight and push? And I am not exactly sure. I mean, I think part of it begins with, you know, a very detailed and loud and analytic dissection of why this is wrong, both from a moral and philosophical level, but also just like from, you know, an efficiency point of view as well.
Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, will this send me spiraling out of my routine?
Time to consult the online experts.
Hi, Felicia here with 1 million followers. That bite will destroy your metabolism.
Is it really that bad? I had protein this morning. Ugh, but it looks so good.
Only eat after walking 10,000 steps.
Pie is only 2 steps from here. Am I overthinking again? Oh, the kids would really love this.
Insulin sensitivity.
Are we
Stop it.
They don't know your body, only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear, just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at signos.com. That's SIGNOS.com with code SPARK. Signos.
It's called leadership. If there's a collective action problem, that's actually about a breakdown in the system because of a lack of courage. And I think one of the slippery slopes is sort of the endless rationalizations that can get invoked when people sort of, you know, invoke, you know, their responsibility to shareholders, which says that that's why I have to cave, or that's why I have to kiss the ring, right, or that's why I've got to put the cash on the table, or that's why I've got to give them a gift. I mean, this is a collective action problem, but it's actually about individual leaders acting like leaders and showing courage. And that's what there's been an absence of. And the only way to solve that kind of problem is through a collective action that actually creates new coalitions. And that's where I want to end up.
Yeah.
With you.
Yeah.
You've written and co-written books about independent voters and look for, you know, realigning shifts in politics that haven't quite materialized. There was a time when it looked like the post-Bush Republican
so
Party
close,
would get more libertarian.
Yeah.
They went
yeah.
the opposite way. So yeah. In an attempt to find something hopeful and redeeming, you know, where do you see the opportunity to build some new coalitions so we can straighten our civic backbone and push back against this stuff, which is an absolute threat to liberal and I would say to that derivation libertarian values?
I think in a lot of ways this is going to be, and this is not as satisfying as a kind of, you know, more broad-based strategy, but a lot of it is going to be on, you know, ad hoc coalitions on specific issues. And so things like trade, I think you're going to start to see businesses that need imports banding together to push back on this instead of just trying to carve out individual exceptions for themselves. And, you know, I think you can see on certain types of issues that have been pushed to the back burner, but things like drug policy, you know, there are weird coalitions growing up between kind of right wing and left wing people who want more pharmaceuticals in the pipeline. And weirdly, you know, it seemed like Trump was signaling that he was going to reduce the burden of the FDA on pharmaceuticals. But then you put in somebody like RFK, who seems to only be interested in punishing pharmaceuticals for imagined sins of the past. Right. But, you know, I think when you look at these kind of, you know, when you look at the ad hoc coalitions, that's going to be a place, you know, Silicon Valley, and this is where somebody like Elon Musk might actually have a constructive role to play. He needs high tech immigrants, you know, in order to do his work. Most of Silicon Valley needs, you know, they need immigrants, not because there aren't Americans who can do these jobs, but, you know, most of them are employed and then they need more and they need, you know, and they need better. So I think that's part of it. I also, I'm heartened by, you know, Rand Paul seems to be ready to play a leadership role this time around in a way that he was not. You know, he is standing up to Trump. I think Thomas Massie in the House is doing that. It's, you know, it's a sad thing. This isn't going to win me any love from Kentucky, but it's a sad thing when it's like a couple of politicians from Kentucky are the last best hope of kind of libertarian values of limited government and free markets. But, you know, it's kind of interesting when you see somebody like Thomas Massie working with Ro Khanna to push on the Epstein files, which, you know, and I don't have real interest in the Epstein files, and I think it's a sideshow, but it might end up being a meaningful way of kind of puncturing Trump's power. But it's interesting to see far right and far left, you know, kind of coming together to restrain, you know, kind of BS coming out of the government.
And that's what I'm talking about. That's the hopeful strain. I think the final evolutionary question is, do you think that could you see libertarians backing a Democratic candidate for president who had policies they could connect with as a check on this kind of Trumpist?
Yeah, I think so. And this is where, you know, and it's way too soon to tell. But, you know, somebody like Jared Polis in Colorado, who was a congressman for 10 years, a Democrat, who was a member of the Freedom Caucus when he was in Congress, and he's a very successful governor. You know, there's things he does that I don't agree with, but he is a pro-business Democrat who is in favor of drug legalization, of school choice, of immigration. Like he could make a sale, I think, to, you know, the 80% of people who are kind of in the center who feel left out of extreme political battles right now. I think somebody like Shapiro conceivably could. You know, part of it, I don't think people like Gavin Newsom could because their record as governor is terrible. It will also be interesting to see if there are Republican, you know, whether they're governors or senators who also make a pitch to Democrats or to moderate, you know, these terms are terrible to say, like a moderate leftist or something, or a moderate right, but like a centrist, you know, a centrist liberal, a Republican who can actually say, what I want to do is make it easier to run your business, and I'm not going to try and, you know, make sure that you live to my moral code. And, you know, I'm going to overturn re-overturn Roe v. Wade or put in an abortion, you know, amendment. And I'm going to have a jihad against gay, you know, gay rights or something like that. Like a Republican who kind of talks that way could also be different. But I ultimately think it's going to be somebody in the center who can speak to both without, you know, with and basically just saying, like, I'm going down the middle. We should have free speech. We should have more freedoms than we have. And we're going to be legitimate, and we're not going to just start the next round of payback, because that's what's happened. You know, it's like this whole century, we've just been going back and forth from Republicans suck, Democrats come in, they suck, you know, and then it's back and forth, and we're just not getting anywhere. I think the next person will be a synthesis who's like, hey, you know what, we're going back to a model of governance that we saw in the late 90s, which was quite popular and productive.
Amen, brother. The middle 60. We need to restore some stability.
I think it's middle 80 right now, though. You know, it's, listen, I mean,
that's even more heartening from your lips to God's ears, as they say. Nick Gillespie, thank you for joining us on How to Fix It. Be well.
Thank you, John.